Welcome to TA1, everything you wanted to know about adventure racing and people that are interesting to me. Kind of change that up a little bit. So, a double tonight, Rachel Furman and Eric Kincannon, names that are well known in the adventure race community. Rachel more so as a racer, Eric, even though he's a racer, and a good one, or I like him anyway. Really known for his dot watching, his ability to figure out what's going on by watching the maps, and generally keeping everybody in the loop what's going on at races. He's always my go-to guy when I'm trying to catch up to a race. So anyway, they have both started orienteering clubs, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. So enjoy the episode. So be safe out there. Hit your marks. Remember, you almost never have gone too far. So thanks for listening. Bye.
Ta-da.
Hey, sorry, I was a little delayed. Well, never mind.
That's fine. Wait, I was the one delayed. What are you talking about?
Oh, well, darn. I was trying to be fashionably late.
You guys were, you both entered within like 10 seconds of each other. So,
hey, all right.
How'd that sound?
Perfect.
Oh, well planned. Thanks, Randy, for arranging this. I'm both looking forward to chatting as well as hearing Rachel's story a little more, because I've already bugged her a little about her club. So
it's all right. Bug away. I need to be bugged.
All right. So first, before we start, I got to make a fool of myself. So Rachel, were you an episode once while you were in a car?
Was I what?
Were you on an episode with your team while you were driving somewhere?
An episode?
With teammates. So obviously it wasn't you.
No.
Okay. I was trying to remember because
no,
Eric has never been on, huh?
No, never been on.
Well, we should have fixed that sooner. But, and Eric, you got a little mini episode one time, right?
I can't. I definitely have heard my name mentioned a few times you and others.
So, yeah, I think we did something. I don't remember. Paulette was doing something and you were helping out. But
yeah. Maybe in the days of the virtual champs.
Yeah, I don't remember. And I was going to go back and look, and I'm like, no, that's too much work.
Yeah. 300 plus episodes. Yeah.
300 plus episodes. Yeah. So, okay. Well, ladies first, Rachel, who are you?
Well, my name is Rachel Furman. I am an adventure racer and orienteer and mountain biker, trail runner, all the above. I live in Little Rock, Arkansas, and I've been adventure racing actually since, and orienteering kind of around the same time, since like 2007-ish, somewhere in that range.
Yeah. So you're becoming an OG, aren't you?
I know. Yes. It's sad. I was thinking about that and I'm like, I don't, yeah, I'm hit my 40s now.
Oh, way. And Eric, who are you other than Dot Watcher extraordinaire?
Yeah, right. I'm Eric Kincannon. I live in Lander, Wyoming, which is not quite dead center in the state, but right at the edge of the country's first wilderness, or largest wilderness, I'm sorry, the Wind River Wilderness. I have been participating in orienteering activities since around 95. And adventure races, I think I did my first adventure race in 97. It was the High Tech series. I did like three races with my team that year in the western part of the US. Got, of course, trounced by like Team Nike and all those other really fast people, but we had tons of fun. And have been just engaged with and following both orienteering and adventure racing relatively consistently in all those, oh boy, almost 30 years now.
You really are OG.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. If I grow this out, like, it looks gray already, but wait till it's long, just like you.
Paulette. Yeah, Paulette just said yesterday before she left, said you're totally white now. I'm like, well, yeah, I'm the whitest person you know, so why shouldn't my beard and a little bit of hair be white? But so what does Rachel and Eric, Rachel in Arkansas, Eric in Wyoming, what do you two have in common right now? And that would be starting adventures or orienteering.
Yes. Brand new orienteering clubs. Woohoo. What
Rachel,
yeah.
go ahead. I was just gonna say Rachel started a club in Arkansas. It's the first one in Arkansas, I believe, right?
Yeah, actually, when I moved here, so I was, super active in the club up in Illinois where I lived there. The club up in Peoria is called IRVOC, Illinois River Valley Orienteering Club, and that's very they still are very active, one meet a month or so. And when I moved here, I looked, and according to Orienteering USA, there was a club in Arkansas, and it was called ALTOS, which stood for Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas Orienteering Society. But when I checked out their website and actually contacted them, like every single one of their meets is in Louisiana. And they don't have any maps for Arkansas. So I was like, oh, okay. So yeah, we've kind of been without a club. I know there's some activity up in Northwest Arkansas as well, but I don't think they've actually initiated a club yet either. So, but it's definitely there's interest in the state because there's it's a very outdoorsy state. So
And you got lots of adventure races happening where people need the training, if for no other reason to orienteer, but to like maybe not have such a hard time with the nav in an adventure race.
So Eric, what was the impetus for you?
Similar. My first orienteering was actually with the Bay Area Orienteering Club because I lived in Oakland, and that's one of the OG orienteering clubs in the United States. Some of the like big names in orienteering, you'll see their names all over books and things, or members of the Bay Area Orienteering Club back in the like 80s and 90s. The first event I ever did there was actually on the campus of Stanford University. So more like an urban race, but of course campuses can be a little less urban and a little bit of like foresty scene. And it was like I was hooked. Like from that point forward, like, oh my God, I'm gonna do a lot more of this. This is totally fun. It's right up my alley. I'm totally like a spatial engineering type, and it is perfect for me. When I life changes happened, I ended up moving to Northern California, Humboldt County, for those who are familiar with the Northern California region. That's where pot used to be. That used to be the main crop there. Not anymore because now it's legal. But anyway, there was no orienteering anywhere near me there. Like I'd have to drive back down to the Bay Area for it, or drive to Portland. So Northern Oregon is almost the same distance to just go back to the Bay Area. It's like okay, jonesing for it, would get opportunities here and there, and then eventually we moved to Wyoming, and it didn't get better. Not only did the distances increase, the times decreased though, because you drive faster and there's no traffic. The clubs are also less mature. The Bay Area Orienteering Club has like two, three meets a month all year round, and then in the summer months it's like one a week, basically, or something like that, some kind of event. At least last I looked carefully, maybe it's changed, but very busy club and lots of maps. Oh my gosh. Unbelievable how many different areas they can go on a course. Moved to Wyoming and there was nothing. The nearest orienteering club is in Salt Lake City, Orienteering Utah, which is also run by an adventure racer. I'll give Ian Hogue a call out here, as well as Fletcher Hamill, who's also one of the board members, I believe, but definitely the marketing guru in that club. And I go down and visit with those guys and run around once in a while, but it's a long drive. To run around for an hour in the woods when you have to drive 10 hours round trip, is a little bit hard to justify frequently. However, when Randy Erickson and his crowd in the Black Hills, which is just about as far away from me as Utah, decides to put on a random road game, now we're talking because, okay, I can drive 10 hours round trip for a 6 hour road game or whatever. That's totally reasonable. But no, that's about it. Later, I discovered that the Front Range Orienteering Club, which is also a quite large club, but it's pretty far, like 6 plus hours to get to any of their mapped areas. They come up to Laramie frequently, like once a year. So Laramie is only 4 hours away. Ooh, closer. And there happens to be a really excellent set of maps in the Laramie area. Those of you who raced Kirkcaldy, which I know is Rachel, and I know Randy's been there. That mountainous, you did Kirk, you did the Cowboy Tough. I said Kirkcaldy, I meant the Cowboy Tough.
Yes.
Forgive me.
Yes, I have done
Yes, the very
that.
first Cowboy Tough started at Kirkcaldy State Park,
Okay.
and whipped around through the whole region up there. Went to Vedavu, which is kind of a rock climbing haven, and then down through Laramie and off through Wyoming, right? So between Laramie and Kirkcaldy State Park is this land that is all Forest Service, and it is called the can't remember the name of the forest, doesn't matter. It's the region is often referred to as like Happy Jack. And there's like, I don't know, more than 2 dozen maps because there's a gent who lives in Laramie who is actually a past USA Orienteering racer in the 90s, named Michael Platt. And he's like a researcher in the physics department, I believe, at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. And he's been mapping this place because it's fun, not because he wants anybody to like do an orienteering event, just because it's fun. And then once a year, the Front Range Orienteering Club kind of like, hey, let's do a weekend like Memorial Day or Labor Day. And we'll do it up there, and everybody will come and camp out because there's plenty of space for that. And it's beautiful weather, and the orienteering is fantastic. So that was my like, ooh, I get to go do some like significant orienteering that's worth the time or the drive. So 3 days straight, like drive down one day and orienteer that morning, and then the next morning, and the next morning. And when they really get big, sometimes they do 6 days in a row. They'll do like 3 days before the holiday weekend, and then 3 more days of the holiday weekend. And sometimes that holiday weekend stuff is like a national ranking event. So really big turnout. There'll be people from Canada, Maine, and all over the place will come. So like that exposure is like fantastic, but it's still really far away. And so the motivation is back to like, okay, I really want to have orienteering as an opportunity. It's great for me and my brain and all the other like things that make me happy. So I guess I have to make a club happen and start getting some maps made for the Lander area. And of course, right here by the wilderness area, there's loads and loads of people that want to come here and explore, just like in Arkansas. And so we've got people that live here that are explorers. We have people that are like professionals in the like game and fish and Forest Service, and you name it. And all those folks are eager to go out and run around maps if I can get them made.
That's
That
cool.
is the key.
Yep. So,
That's
Rachel, I probably a lot of people do know, but what exactly is orienteering? Because you got orienteering, you got road game, you got adventure racing, but
That's a very good question because actually, a lot of people around here know me for adventure racing and know adventure racing pretty well. And so there's sometimes I have to really explain it. Like it is a different sport. Like it's obviously connected. Navigation is key and map and compass is your base. But orienteering is much more focused on and of course the basic orienteering is on foot. But I personally have done mountain bike orienteering at higher levels and then there's ski orienteering and there's different modes. But orienteering as a sport is generally as Eric mentioned, only an hour, it's much shorter than an adventure race because you're solely focused on your course. The courses will depend on skill level, and so you set a skill level course to, match the people who are doing it, so Orienteering USA and International Orienteering Federation have, I guess, standards, you know, that you're going by to set your courses. So a very easy course is going to be really short. The controls are going to be on trails, routes are going to be very obvious on your maps, and you know, controls are going to be set really high up so you can see them very easily. And then of course it gets more difficult from there, longer controls, much more close to the ground and on very features that you may not easily see on the map, or you really have to study the map very, very quickly. And then the big thing about orienteering, typically your meets, you're getting to your controls in order. So you have to go one, two, three, four, five. You know, you can't, like a rogue aim, which is the other thing that you mentioned, is a style where you can get the controls in any order. So strategy is different in that case. But yeah, so orienteering is basically, you know, you get a map, you get controls, and you get a start point. You get, once you start, you go, and it's timed. And the really, you know, high level fun courses are where it's all electronic, and you just have a little electronic stick that you use when you get to the control. It marks that you got there, and then when you download your results later, you totally nerd out on all of your information about how fast it took you to get from control one to control two, and where you messed up, and you know how much time you lost or whatever. It's super fun for the nerds of the world, I think. But it's also just a really great mix of athleticism and brain. Like, you gotta have both. So it's what makes it so much fun.
Is it a little more physical than a road game or adventure racing because it's short and fast, so you really are, you got to be fast, right?
Well, so again, I think one of my favorite things about orienteering as well is that it is so open to everybody. So, I mean, you can take, you know, on your really easy courses, you've got families with little kids, you know, you can even be on a stroll, you know, have a stroller, because most, you know, if you're on paved paths or something. But, and then of course, as you get older and you're maybe a little slower, you can still do the more technical courses, but they're shorter because they have standards for those as well. But yeah, I mean, the really good people, they're running like sub 20-minute 5Ks through the woods reading a map. Like, it's just amazing. It's so amazing to watch, you know, at the world championship level, how fast these people are. I was just, as a super quick story, since Eric was talking about Laramie, probably one of my favorite orienteering experiences actually was in Sweden, because every year there is, and you may have heard of it, the festival called O-Ringen, and it is a week long, you know, orienteering festival. There's like 12 to 20,000 people there from all over the world, mostly Europe though, to be honest. But it's still it's just really, really cool to see that many orienteering events in one spot, because you're literally using the same area, but yet there's like 20 courses going on at the same time. So, you know, you get to a control, you better make sure it's yours, because it may not be, you know, it may be on somebody else's course and not yours. So it's just really, really cool, fun event. If anybody ever gets the chance to go do it, I recommend it.
I remember thinking, speaking of like the size of orienteering events in Europe, I remember like somebody when drones, Randy, you've got one, maybe you've got more than one actually. When drones first became kind of a new thing and they were out around, somebody had a drone hovering over the start of a Rogaine in like a 24-hour Rogaine in, I think it was Finland. I can't remember exactly which country, but it was unbelievable how many people were in the starting chute. And it took like 5 minutes for everybody to finally clear through the starting gate, essentially. Their times didn't start until they hit the gate, right? But they all are in a mass start. It was like thousands and thousands of people in this 24-hour row game. And it's like, oh my God, land managers must not care too much about like the impact. But of course, a row game has the advantage of people going all kinds of different directions, so the impacts are dispersed.
Although, yeah, I will say I've run into land managers, the control location matters, because that's where everybody converges. So anyway.
So yeah, you're not getting that 1,000 people running down the trail to it, but you are getting 1,000 people coming from 360 degrees, right? So yeah, that makes sense. So the maps are a little bit different orienteering. So explain that, one of you. I don't care who, because as long as you're talking, I don't have to.
Go ahead, Rachel. I can chime
No,
in if you
well,
want.
I can ex I can if you want to take a foot, I'll do a mountain bike orienteering map since it's
Oh,
cool.
sure. Great. Yeah. So I think the key thing about an orienteering map is just that the level of detail is much higher than on really any other map you're going to find. Even like the people who do GIS surveys, which of like for certain kinds of wildlife or plants or whatever, they're going to have pretty detailed maps, right? But they're only mapping one thing or maybe a group of things. Whereas on an orienteering map, we're trying to make sure that all the information that's needed for a navigator to make decisions about route are on their maps, because they have to think ahead, like, oh, the next control is, off that way to the northeast, and I got a bearing, but do I really want to follow this bearing, or do I want to take a different route because along that bearing is some problem, like a cliff or a cliff band or a lake or some other uncrossable feature, or just steep terrain that you could cross but would be really slow. Why not just go around the steep terrain or pick some other route? With that reasoning in mind, there's different colors of green that go on an orienteering map to indicate like different kinds of vegetation. Is it sort of runnable but slow vegetation? That's going to be lighter green. And then there's like thick, quite slow vegetation. You probably don't want to try running through it, even though you could. And then there's fight, which is like super dark green, and truly you aren't moving through it. Like you could, but I mean, it's just a complete waste of your time. That's just one example. Of course, blue is used for water features, including marshy areas as well as lakes, and those are all marked in either specific colors or specific patterns of the blue, so that you can make decisions about, okay, that might be runnable, but it also might be mud up to my hips, or it might be a river and it might be uncrossable right now because of whatever season you're in or something. So you can make all those kinds of judgment calls based on the details on the map. And then even more information comes from contour lines, which are already on most of the USGS quads that those of us in the US are familiar with, or any other topographical map that we're familiar with. There's contour lines, right? Well, on most orienteering maps, because the scale is so much closer in, the contour lines and contour intervals can be smaller. So instead of having like a 2 meter contour interval, you might have like a 1 meter or 1.5 meter contour interval or something like that, so that there's more contour lines on the map to show more of the detail of the terrain. Because the more you spread them out, the more things get washed out, and you can't see that between this contour and that contour, it looks like it's kind of smooth, but when you get there's like this giant rock band that doesn't show up. All sorts of things like that. And then additionally, there's all these black features that go on the map that are all either rock, like behind Rachel is a fantastic rock feature.
Yeah, Buffalo National River.
Yeah. And then also all like man-made objects, with a couple exceptions, but almost all man-made objects show up black. So fence lines, power lines, whatever else you can imagine, buildings, of course, wellheads. I mean, there's just a vast number of man-made things that can show up on a map, but all those little details help navigators make choices as they're moving. Like, okay, I'm going to navigate object to object on that are showing up on my map, or I'm going to follow this trail, and I'm going to use some other object that's on my map as a marker for, okay, here's where I need to make a turn or where I need to make a decision or whatever. And if you're using a USGS quad, you might have a little bit of veg information because we kind of have some green sometimes. You definitely have contour lines, and you're probably going to have like trails and roads, but not buildings necessarily. Sometimes there'll be a little symbol for a church, but it won't actually be the size of the church. It'll just be the symbol. So the church might be 10 times the size of a little symbol. So there's just much more detail, but also trying not to get too detailed. Like I just saw a great example of a map that had way too much detail on it. It actually made it hard to navigate because it was just too much clutter. So map making is actually an art as much as it is kind of scientific. What's too little and what's too much, and what makes it fair for all orienteers of all levels to navigate. So that's foot orienteering. Mountain bike orienteering has some little variations, but.
Well, before we get to that, does it take you to so that reading the map is just automatic? When you started, how long did it take before you didn't have to say, oh, that's this color green, that's this, you know?
I missed some of that. You broke up. So I
Oh.
think you're asking, go repeat it.
So how long does it take, did it take you to be comfortable with knowing what's on the map and not having to stop to think what this symbol means and what that symbol means?
I think because I started on a like an urban orienteering course where most things were black, including roads and all sorts of things, I got introduced somewhat more slowly than somebody who just jumped onto like a map on a wild place, where there's all those details that maybe are extraneous, but they're still cluttering your mind as you're trying to look at where you want to go. So I got to introduce slowly. I probably took me 5 years to feel like I had a pretty good grip on like looking at a orienteering map and knowing somewhat intuitively what it is I'm looking at.
Yeah.
I've always been lucky, I guess. Like contour lines just jump out at me. I've never been like the type who looks at contour lines and has to scratch my head. But I've taught a lot of people navigation who are just like baffled by contour lines. So maybe I just have an advantage there. It was all the other stuff that's on an orienteering map that took me a while to kind of get figured.
Was there ever a eureka moment where, because I can think back, this doesn't happen to me very much because I'm not a good navigator, but all of a sudden you're looking at the map, you see it all in your head, completely on the ground. Did you ever have that moment? And then it's like, oh, this is how it's supposed to be done.
I can't claim that I've had a moment when I suddenly was able to do that. But there's absolutely certain kinds of maps where you look at them, and to me, it's like, oh my God, like I know, like I've got a map in my head now. Like,
Yeah.
maybe I don't remember where all the little rocks and other little details are, but like I suddenly know that there's this massive drainage and there's these massive spurs and all these other things. When it's like really good orienteering terrain, it doesn't look like that.
Yeah.
It's normally like very, not flat, but like, yeah, it can be much more complex and hard to really visualize. I don't know about Rachel.
So Rachel, what is mountain bike orienteering like, and how do you do that?
Yeah, so it's a little different. Just first off, the map is a little different in that the trails and roads, obviously, you're on a bike. So, and some races and some areas do allow you to go off trail, and usually those rules are clearly stated, and also then usually course design, kind of will follow, so it might make sense to try to go off trail in an area or not, but typically you're going to be staying on roads or trails or something where you can actually be on your bike riding. But so the map is done a little differently in that just the actual way that the trails and roads and things are marked is done by rideability. So kind of what Eric was talking about with the woods, vegetation, coloring, depending on, it's not telling you that it's really thick woods or it's not telling you the type of vegetation necessarily. It's just telling you how quickly you might be able to move through it. It's the same concept for the roads and the trails. It's how quickly you can actually ride along it. So even something that's a single track, if it's super smooth, fast single track, it actually will look bigger, as a road, it almost looks very wide trail, and if you're thinking about it in terms of a regular foot map, versus maybe a big, double track road, but it's a logging road and it's been totally rutted out and you're not, you're going to be off your bike several times just trying to ride it. So that will actually be look that will be marked on a map as a very thin, small dashed line because it's reflecting the fact that it's slower travel. So that's one of the main differences.
That sounds counterintuitive.
It is.
I mean,
It can
does
get you
that take you a
sometimes
little
if you're.
while? Yeah.
If if you're coming to it from foot orienteering, like a lot of people are, you're used to seeing like, hey, a solid dashed line means it's a single track, and a solid black line means it's a road, and that is not necessarily the case for mountain bike orienteering, when the maps are done, to the right standard. So it takes a little getting used to because your route choice depends. It can be a good one or a bad one, depending on how well you read those details. So
And mountain bike orienteering is the same, right? Got to get them in order.
Yes,
Yeah.
yeah. Yep. And I will say, obviously not at the like super informal events like what I'm planning to have, to start with my club. But, once you get to higher levels, if you miss a checkpoint, like if you get a control out of order, or if you miss one altogether, you get DQ'd. Like it's serious as far as the getting them in order. So.
Interesting. So, Rachel, what you're like, I'm going to have an orienteering event. I need a map. What are the steps in getting a good orienteering map that you have to go through and that you're working on?
You mean that I'm still in the process of?
Yeah. How do you, I mean, well, how do you
Yeah.
start? Do you just pick an area, you look at a map,
Yeah.
walk us through it.
So for a long time, I've actually had o the OCAD software. And Eric, I don't know if you have that or not, but I
Nope,
have
not yet.
OCAD and I have Purple Pen, which is another software that's we used pretty heavily to create courses with Irvoc, where my old club. But so OCAD is basically a makes you think of AutoCAD if you're an engineer, because that's basically what it is, just a software for mapping. So that's really my starting point, is to try to import the base layer maps into that, and then use that to build all the features that Eric was talking about, like boulders and fences and buildings and whatever. So actually creating a map is really time consuming, to do it well, and to do it with the level of detail that makes it a really good orienteering map versus just a USGS, one to 24,000 scale map, that doesn't have all that detail on it. So it's definitely a process. I really honestly have not done it fully myself. I've just started the process, but I've watched it, being done, and it's just going out and taking your map and marking it up as you go with what needs to be on the map, and then coming back and putting it in on the software. So kind of repeating that process. So.
So, any idea roughly like hours it would take to make a good orienteering map?
Probably depends on the size of the area you're looking at. I do know just from experience, there was a pretty large, I mean large for Illinois, a large state park that we put a 6 hour Rogaine on. So it was large enough for 6 hour Rogaine. And the number of hours that it took to actually get that map up to, really good standard, it was, oh, I don't know, days. I mean, it was a long time.
Takes a
Yeah,
lot of work.
I haven't ever built a map yet. I've got some in progress. I've actually had some other orienteers, actually not just in the US, but also elsewhere in the world, offer to just like
Yeah, there are people who can
help.
help. So
Like
that's the nice thing.
they'd like literally say, like, tell me where, like, give me either grid coordinates or whatever. And give me a rough sense of where the perimeter is of the area you want to map, and I'll find the base layers for you and get them all imported into a file. And then, like, in fact, the gent who did one for me already, like, it only took him like less. He got the information one day, and I had a map already the next day, essentially. But it had no detail other than some cool things that he did. He pulled in recently created LIDAR data. And those who don't know what LIDAR is, it's basically planes fly over and they send lasers to the ground to measure the topography. And the lasers can see through like the trees and all this other canopy. There's a limit to that, of course, but like mostly they can see through all that and can give you really accurate topographical information instead of USGS quads, which mostly are 50 or 80 years old, the contour information, which contours don't change much, but still the data is not that granular. So he pulled that in. And then the other thing he did, which is totally just brilliant in my mind, was he went to Strava and pulled up a heat map for the whole area that showed people's movement through the terrain, and just used that heat map to figure out where the trails were. Even if you couldn't see them on the satellite image or whatever else, like, well, there's obviously a trail right here because there's a lot of people going through there. It's brilliant. So with all that information, I now have a rough map that he said, like, here's I'll give you two options. You can either go out and start field checking it, and we can do what Rachel described, make notes all over the map and improve it. Or you can just run a super informal event there and get feedback from all the people who are participating about, well, that didn't go that way, and there was this fence in the way, or whatever. And just let them know up front that it's not perfect, but you're helping me, vet this map. But barring that, like, I've already inquired about, they have Orienteering USA has a grant program for mapping school properties, the youth development program. And I've just looked at, like, okay, what's that cost? And or what would it cost to pay someone, and how much grant money would I need? It's, $5,000 to $8,000, depends on some details there. And probably like 40 hours of total time, but that's both field checking and map improvement. Like, most of that time is really spent in the field. It's not really the fiddling around on a CAD.
But yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of people who are much better experts at this kind of thing. So I think that's who we have to really help kind of rely on, at least here at the beginning. But informal events, maybe with not perfect maps, I think that's kind of where I finally just decided like something's better than nothing, like get it started, and then the all the fine work detail can come as you go. So
Yeah, and I mean, I think Rachel, you had a plan for doing a Rogaine of some length. I can't remember the
yeah,
distance
so one
or
of the
time.
first things, and I mean that's not even going to be necessarily an orienteering map. I'll probably use the USGS, kind of one, just some 1 to 24,000 scale, just to at least have a Rogaine, have an orienteering event, because I think those are a little, I guess, easier to put on in a way. So
Well,
just
they
like,
don't have to be quite as detailed, right? So they're a little easier.
Yeah, and you place the controls. I mean, they're so much farther apart that it's a aha moment when you find it, because it's like every half hour you find one or something. rather than every 3 minutes or 5 minutes on our engineering course or something like that. So, like, it doesn't have to be in a difficult placement. It can be at a trail junction every time, or some other like really obvious feature that you don't have to map. Like, it's already on the map. Like, trail junctions are on the map, and like, hilltops are on the map. That's why adventure
That's a
races
good place.
frequently have those places for controls, because they're using those quality of maps, and those are very distinct features. Of course, it also forces, if it's a hilltop, it forces people to go to the top and then come back down. But
All right, so we have to stop this meeting and start another one.
oh, right.
So because I'm too
Three
cheap to play
minutes.
anymore. And so when we come back, we'll talk about you guys want to do with your clubs and what you got coming up and what's going to happen. So I'll message you the link in about 30 seconds.
Okay.
Sounds good. Think it's working.
Recording in progress. Eric's not back yet.
I
He's slow.
beat him this time.
There you go. Oh, there he is. This doesn't work too bad. Having to do it, with two, during the pandemic and stuff. I don't know. Meetings were, I don't. They were free. It seemed like forever, or there was no time limit. So,
I know. Took advantage of that.
Connecting to audio.
Hi all.
There he is. No. Let me close. Let me move that out of the way. And we are recording. I learned eventually to always make sure the recording is button is going.
Didn't you do a Kyle Peter interview years ago where, like, you had the whole thing twice because it's the first time you didn't record?
Oh, it was like the fourth one or fifth one it did. Yeah, that was I kind of glad it was with somebody like that that was okay with it. So Eric, what's the club name? Speed Goat?
Speed Goat Orienteering. And for those who don't know what Speed Goat means, it's the very prolific, all over everywhere in the West, pronghorn. People often refer to them as pronghorn antelope, although they're not really actually antelope. Anyway, they're their own thing. And people, the slang term for them is speed goats because they're really fast. And I just thought that was like, man, that's perfect for orienteering. Like,
Yeah.
not everybody wants to be a speed goat when they're orienteering. Some just want to go out and have the intellectual experience. But some folks really will, like, go as hard as they can and come back totally gassed and collapse on the finish line and all that.
So how has the reception been? Are you getting a lot of interest? And then, I mean, what are your plans for the next 6 months?
Well, it's really like I'm really in the early stages. I quite literally just like put the word out to the community like 2 weeks ago. I've been thinking and talking about doing this for a couple years, but just the circumstances have kind of come together to make this a reasonable time. There's been lots of really positive response from the community. I'm in a very small community relative to Little Rock for sure. What's your My population here is about 7,000 people. And there's another, like Fremont County, this whole county that I'm in, maybe has 25,000 people. So the number of people that are going to come orienteering is pretty limited, but there's just so many outdoor enthusiasts. There's a vast number of people that are either hook or bullet folks that spend a lot of time in wild places. I mean, they're not just going fishing in the like super simple, like pull off the side of the road and jump in the river. Like they're going up into the wilderness to go looking for special trout or whatever. And those folks get just as lost and need their navigation skills to be, reasonably good, as anybody else who goes up into the backcountry. So, got that whole community in addition to, scouts. Both Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, there's loads of them here, as well as the search and rescue units, because we have wilderness areas where people get lost all the time. We have significant number of search and rescue people in the region. We have one right here in Fremont County, but then there's also one on the other side of the Winds, which is a different county. It's where Pinedale is, and then not too far away is the Tetons in Jackson, and they've got like super high tech search and rescue unit there, because people get in trouble, in significant trouble, way up high on the t up on the Grand, and they're helicopter rescues and all that. And when we have a big we have a big search and rescue, mostly search activity in the Winds, it's often all three of those units plus even some more from other parts of the state that get involved. So those folks are super excited about having the opportunity to either partner with the club in a way that means that they're always present when we're doing a orienteering meet, which means that it takes a little bit of burden off of me to make sure that everybody comes back. Like, I want everybody to come back, right? But if they don't come back, I've got like search and rescue folks that can initiate that rather than me having to figure out how to like mobilize a search for people who are not home yet. Because that, unfortunately, that does happen, or at least you have to plan for it. And so that, and then the other side of that partnership with Search and Rescue would be that, they would love it if I would host orienteering events for them as training. And I don't know yet whether or not that could be something that's also welcoming the public, because what they would want is instead of checkpoints with, pin punches or e punches or whatever, and orienteering flags, that there's an orienteering flag and then a skill station for their search and rescue skills. If it's, skills like show us how to do CPR or show us how to, build a litter out of whatever materials are nearby, things like that. So that's there. And then of course there's just all the other outdoor users. There's lots of mountain bikers here. There's lots of Nordic skiers here, which I bet you don't have in Arkansas. And so like all those folks are excited about the potential for, I can put a map together for one particular area up in the Winds that's Forest Service, it's not wilderness, but that could be used for, with tweaks to the map, because the maps are all different, but it could be used for mountain bike and foot orienteering events in the summer, but then Nordic skiing events in the winter, sort of ski orienteering. And it's still three different maps, but with very subtle changes. So lots of interest. And I actually spent part of the morning today at a local like coffee shop bakery, at actually at the suggestion of the owner of the bake shop, to just like, you know, have a orienteering flag hanging on a chair and just seeing who stops and asks. And you know, it was not a lot of people, but it was enough people that it's like, all right, there's some interest out there, and it'll take time for the knowledge that this exists and is going on to spread. But I'm not in a hurry. I recognize that I'm not going to build a big complicated map in a place that's super far away and get anybody to show up right now.
Yeah. So your expectations are not limited, but tamp down a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, we'll probably get into it, but like the first events I would like to do are going to be right here in town. We're not going to like go an hour and a half drive on the paved then dirt road to a beautiful place to go orienteering in the woods. Because who's going to show up? Like nobody has the skills or the time, you know. And once people are addicted to orienteering in the way that I've become, then sure, there'll be more people who are willing to take that drive to like do this fantastic, you know, orienteer on this fantastic terrain.
Well, is that hard for you? Because you want to, you want to take them out in the middle of nowhere where it's perfect, but you real was that a hard realization to say, no, we got to do it in the city park?
No, I mean, I think I've always realized that there needed to be a little bit of, let's start at a more approachable level. Cause it's just a new sport here. I mean, there are a few people that have exposure to it, in town from various, you know, they've been in the military and they did some form of orienteering as their military like training, or they were in the scouts and they had to get the badge or whatever, but that's such a small number of people that, you know, a lot of them, there's lots of trail runners here, you know, ultra runners that do like 150, 200 mile trail runs, which blows my mind, but whatever. Those folks, like, they've never heard orienteering, which like it's crazy to me. Like, wow, you spend how many hours a year on trails out in the woods training as well as racing, and you don't know about orienteering? Whoa.
That or they think the Barkley marathons are orienteering.
And the misconceptions, right? Like that's one of the things I've run into that I didn't expect is, you know, some folks who have military backgrounds in orienteering, they hear me talk about orienteering, they're like, no way, I want nothing to do with that. Like that was the worst experience in my training. Right? I never want to do orienteering again in my life. You know, that sort of, whoa, okay. Because that in that setting, the training was rigorous and probably painful, as opposed to fun, which is what we're going for here.
So Rachel, I'm guessing or getting the feeling that you're a little farther ahead than Eric is with, well, you started a little earlier. So where are you at? What do you kind of got going?
So I have one official event on the calendar, which I mentioned was the Rogaine. It's going to be a 3, 6, and 12-hour Rogaine. The thought is to bring in people who just kind of want to, dip their toe in a little bit with a 3-hour, and then also hopefully get some folks from out of, like I've gone to Missouri to do Rogaines. Hopefully some folks are willing to come to from Missouri to here or Oklahoma or, close by. I thought about doing an even longer one, but then I was like, eh, I should probably not bite off too much just in case I mean, I've definitely have experience putting on Rogaines and adventure races, but I just want to make sure I don't, mess it up too bad before I move on to something bigger. But as far as smaller events, same as Eric, kind of, we've got some in-town parks and not just here in Little Rock, but also in Hot Springs that are really good candidates for just some informal kind of, come fig, almost like clinics. And that's what I'll end up doing because I have had a few people reach out to me specifically for their group to have like a, a clinic for their, for, a Girl Scout group, for example, a Girl Scout troop. I've had some ROTC people reach out to me. I actually have some people that live like Northeast Arkansas, quite a ways away, but they've been traveling up to St. Louis because St. Louis has a club. And so for them, the travel time, I guess, would be almost the same, if not shorter. So I guess they're willing to come down to some events as well. So I don't, like I said, the official calendar, as far as I have right now is the Rogaine on September 30th. And then I would like to have my first kind of more informal thing by the end of May, but May keeps getting chock full of other things, right? So I'm actually struggling because once it gets hot, which it just kind of started to here in Little Rock, it's not nearly as fun to be outside in the woods, I'll just say.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, I
And I'm a
mean,
little worried about September 30th, but we'll hope for the best.
you've kind of got the flip situation. Like,
Yeah,
your
you're probably
season,
still waiting for spring, and
yeah, your season could probably extend all the way through winter with maybe a little
oh
bit of a
yeah.
limit.
Winter's
Whereas
the best.
my season for summer type orienteering, foot or bike orienteering, my season
Yeah.
ends probably in October and doesn't really restart until April or May. And
Yeah.
even May is questionable. Like right now it's great, but some years May is like, oh, it's still very, very snowy and cold. Randy knows, he's not too far from me.
We're I mean, for us, really, literally, this last week has been the first spring
Yep.
weather
Wow.
we've had. Yeah, so
And it
yeah,
just
it's pretty
like
nice.
hit 90 today here, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think we've gone over 80 yet.
Oh
We've had
gosh.
like a warm spell, but that was like unusual
Yeah.
warm.
Yeah.
So yeah. So we'll wrap this up a little bit with my favorite. You do it. So Rachel, what's yours? What do you got going on this year besides for fun, besides your club? What are you doing? What are you racing?
Well, actually this weekend I'm doing the Rev 3 Endurance Challenge, I guess is what it's called. I don't so that's doing that race and then Nationals, USARA. Honestly, that's all I have on the calendar right now. I actually don't have anything else. So I was just going to kind of wait and see what happens. I started to look at a few things and if I end up doing something solo or try to get a team together for something, I can. But I will be doing course design for our local adventure race again, Raid the Rock. I raced it many years and then have kind of swapped over to the helping side and done course design for it for the past couple of years. So I'll be doing that. And we're hopefully having it in October this year because we have been having it in December and it's kind of cold.
A little
Not
bit.
as cold as where you guys are, but it's cold for us. But anyway, so yeah, really not, yeah, that's kind of it, to be honest. You make me feel like I need to add something.
We'll wait to
You
hear what
don't
I'm
have
doing.
a yeah, you don't have a year at a glance calendar that every weekend is full.
I probably will find a way, don't worry.
Mean, that telling the story a lot. That's literally what's in our kitchen is we have the year at a glance calendar and it's all my stuff, all Paulette's stuff. And it's like, because we got to
Yeah.
coordinate, because we got dog, blah, 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 blah. But it's really fun to look at it and say, gee, look at all the fun things you're going to
Yeah.
do. So,
Well, this is kind of my first, like last year was a total waste for me. I was battling some things. And so this year I'm kind of like, okay, I'm back, but I'm kind of also like, I don't know. We'll just see. Like, what do I feel like doing? I don't know. So.
But well, I will see you at Nationals, so that's a win.
Yeah. Oh, I'm excited. I love Vermont. It's beautiful.
Eric, it sounded like maybe don't have a lot of things going on and for fun.
No, not really. Dot watching will continue, but that's not really an athletic endeavor. It's a sleep challenging endeavor, but that's about it. I mean, I have a loose idea that I'd love to be at the California Orienteering Fest, which has been
Yeah,
rescheduled
I
now
saw that.
twice. But it's happening this summer. I don't have the dates in mind.
It's the end of July. It's like a
Sounds about
full
right.
week. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like a full week of orienteering activities, starting with a
2
few days.
weeks.
Yeah, like full a couple days of orienteering in San Francisco area. So that's back in my old stomping grounds, Bay Area Orienteering Club. But really, it's like a coalition of orienteering clubs from that part of the country that are putting on a bunch of big national ranking events that are up in Tahoe.
Yeah.
And Tahoe is just a smidge closer to me, 5 hours
Need a little
closer.
bit.
And of course, that's orienteering in the woods rather than orienteering. in an urban setting. So that's one thing that's, I don't know. I don't know if I have the money or the time to go to it, but it's interesting to think about. I'll almost certainly be going to the Laramie Days activity, the one I kind of described earlier that happens just about every year. This year, it's going to be another 7 day or 6 day big thing around Labor Day. So that's what the first weekend in September. Things are quite dry around here that time of year, but it is amazing how even when it's super dry in parts of Wyoming, when you go out on those maps, there's plenty of water. Like, oh, look, I'm going to do a stream crossing and I'm going to be really, really, really cold and wet for the rest of this run. But you know, it's beautiful and fun. So I'll probably engage in that at some level. And then the Rev3 Endurance folks, so Mike Spiller and his crew are, I think, coming back again this year to do the, they still call it the Cowboy Tough, but it's a, you know, shorter duration than the like 2.5 to 5 day Cowboy Tough races from several years ago, at Kurt Gowdy State Park. So that's near Laramie and Cheyenne. And I've raced that a few times and I don't know if I want to do it again, but if I'm up for it, I'll consider it. The thing is, as Rachel probably experienced, like once you've raced in a place enough times, you're not navigating anymore. You're just racing. And I kind of lose interest at that level. Like, okay, great. I know where that control is exactly. Put the map away. I know exactly where to turn and how to get there and where not to go and all that, you know. So I don't know that I really want to race in that park
Other,
again.
although, yeah, it is 24 hours this year.
Yeah, I think, was it 24? I thought he said it was 50 hours. I didn't look that carefully.
Well, the one this weekend, next weekend's 50 hours.
Yeah, the
The one
one that
Rachel's going.
it's
Oh, okay.
billed as a 50, but I think it's going to end up being short. I think the 50 is just the cutoff. So,
Yeah, and that's how I always interpret those numbers. Like, even when it's a 12-hour race, I just think of it as like, okay, that's the cutoff. If you're fast and accurate, maybe you're done in 8.5, or you know. Or they put out like 70 controls for 12 hours, and like you could spend all 12 hours out there, you just aren't going to find everything. It's impossible.
Well, cool. I appreciate you guys spending some time, and this hour is nothing compared to what you're going to have to do. So I guess that's not such a big deal, right?
Yeah, no, thanks for having us. I'm super excited. It's been like a few years in the making, or at least a few years that, as Eric said, thought about it. That's pretty much what I've been saying, like, oh, I need to do this. I need to do this. So I'm really excited to finally get it moving and have the support and excitement that some people have shown. So it'll be good.
Yeah,
Well,
same
and you
story.
probably got Eric going, so that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, well,
Yeah.
it definitely was encouragement. I was already going down the path, but it was like stumbling on, wait, Rachel started another one? That's fantastic. And I immediately sent you a message like, how did you deal with this?
And I'll probably bounce some ideas off you too, because I mean, it's just the whole starting anything, any club, not for profit, for 501c3, like there's a lot to learn about all of that. So I'm kind of fumbling my way through it with help of friends. So
It's good that we're not the first. There's plenty of people out there that have the prior experiences. Maybe some of those prior experiences are too far back to be useful, but there are others that have done it recently. Like there's a Grizzly Orienteering Club, which is kind of nearish to me. It's up northwestern Montana. And they just kicked off just a couple years ago. And one of the folks running that's actually one of the top. He is one of the top orienteers living in the US. I don't actually know who he races for, because I think he's from somewhere in Northern Europe. I've forgotten now.
Hard to believe.
Anyway, so like, you know, there's people out there to help support it all. And you know, I appreciate you, Randy, just like, you know, giving us some time to share our story. And I hope that you and Paulette will consider throwing some more Rogaine controls out in the woods and inviting people back to the Black Hills. I'll have more people to bring this time, I hope.
That's true. That's true. Well, it's kind of been in the back of my mind, and like, well, okay, now I've got a little you guys have it made me think about it a little more, so maybe, plus then Eric comes and visits.
I always appreciate more events. I mean, I know sometimes it's like, oh, I'm not going to be able to travel to West Virginia or somewhere, but I did go to the Stockville last year. With that being a 2-day event, it made it in my mind worth it, and it's fun to see other places and do that. So I really enjoy when people put on events. So.
Cool. All right. Well, right here, I'm going to take the dog out. That's always my excuse for ending a podcast.
Yeah,
So
I'm just happy my
thank you
cat
very
hasn't meowed
much.
this whole time.
Yeah.
All
And
right.
good luck everybody with orienteering. Don't get lost.
Yeah.
Thank you. Have a good
Thanks. All
night.
right. Good to see you both.
Bye.
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 Bridges, the embankments and cuts, they blasted and dug with their sweat and their guts. They never drank water but whiskey by pints, and the shanty towns rang with their songs and their fights. Navigator, navigator, rise up and be strong. The morning is here and there's work to be done. Take your pick and your shovel and a bowl of dynamite. Burn a ship a few tons of this earthly delight. Yes, to ship a few tons of. In their hundreds with no sign to mark where, save the brass in the pocket of the entrepreneur. By landslide and rock blast they got buried so deep that in death if not life they'll have peace while they sleep. Navigator, navigator, rise up and be strong. The morning is here and there's work to be done. Take your pick and your shovel and a bowl of dynamite. Burn a ship a few tons of this earthly delight. Yes, to ship a few tons of this earthly delight. Fortunes were made. Supply of an empire where the sun never sets, which is now deep in darkness, but the royal way's there yet. Navigator, navigator, rise up and be strong. The morning is here and there's work to be done. Take your pick and your shovel and a bowl of dynamite. Burn a ship a few tons of this earthly delight. Yes, to ship a few tons of this earthly delight.